When people come to Israel first time, we usually tell them that the purpose of the first trip is to make your itinerary for the second trip. You come to Yeshiva for 5 weeks, what you really need to do is make your itinerary of all the issues that need in-depth exploration for the second trip. We're going to deal with women's roles in Judaism in 2 50-minute sessions. That means we're not going to cover the topic. Surprise, surprise. When you come here for a more leisurely stay of 6 months or 8 months or a year, we take a week or 2 weeks to do it in the morning, and we do it leisurely and cover all the issues. Today I'm going to introduce you to a few of the philosophical ideas. Next week I'll introduce you to the legal issues. Don't raise legal issues today. It's not today's subject. Today is a question of general philosophical orientation, and even that is only once over lightly, but it'll give you an idea. If you want to read about this subject, I know that's a dangerous assumption today that anybody wants to read anything, but if you should happen to want to read something, the book on the subject, the classic, is Jewish Woman in Jewish Law by Moshe Meiselman. I would say a person who has not read that book shouldn't have an opinion on the subject. And I don't carry commission. The problem which plagues discussions of women's role is equality. The assumption is that if you make any distinction between roles, then you must be discriminating against women. It never occurs to anyone you might be discriminating against men. You must be discriminating against women, and therefore the only way to ensure that you are being fair and even-handed is that all roles should be identically open to women and men. I want to point out that in logic, there is no reason to take such a position. We recognize throughout life that there are roles that are quite different from one another, and yet we do not judge one to be superior to the other. A violinist and a pianist playing a Mozart sonata, or even an early Beethoven sonata, violin and piano are very different from one another. Neither one is superior to the other. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Supreme Court Justice play very different roles in American government. It would be very difficult to say that one is clearly superior to the other, the other was inferior and second class, second rate. They're very different roles, they're very, very different functions. And we do not discriminate to say that one is more important than the other. Your computer runs on a combination of hardware and software. No one is going to tell you that hardware is more important than software or software is more important than hardware. It needs a correct combination of both to run altogether. So distinguishing roles does not by itself mean that there is any disadvantage to one role over the other. They can be, in fact, equally valuable. Now, when you ask about equal value, the standard of value should come from within Judaism. If someone looks at the roles of women and men and points out that according to contemporary Los Angeles values, that might be an oxymoron, that women and men are not equally situated to achieve the values of Los Angeles, that won't come as a surprise, because the design of women's and men's roles within Judaism is for the sake of achieving Jewish values. So the only relevant judgment of discrimination would be if the roles are designed in such a way that women cannot achieve what Judaism defines as essential goods. And when you look at it in those terms, the highest spiritual achievement of any human being is prophecy. And according to our sources, in the period of prophecy from Moses to the beginning of the Second Temple, there were 1,200,000 prophets, 600,000 men, 600,000 women. So if I'm measuring the roles defined within Jewish life, women and men, in terms of their success in achieving the key Jewish value, it seems that they are equally situated. One other factual presupposition. In the 60s and into the 70s, it was dogma in the feminist movement that there are no essential differences between women and men. All the differences you see in adults are the result of socialization, programming, projecting prejudiced values. But there are no essential differences. Well, I would say a majority in the feminist movement have abandoned that position in the face of overwhelming evidence. But for those who may be lingering back about 20 years out of date, let me just point out a few facts. Number one, certain physical differences, which were known and were investigated and re-emphasized, do have to be taken into account. Not just reproductive systems, but hormones, which play a large role in determining a person's attitudes, responses. So much so that some have said that all men are diseased with testosterone poisoning, because we have 20 times as much testosterone as women, and that leads to violent and aggressive responses. So the hormonal structure is different between women and men. It will lead to certain differences of character. The organization of the brain is different in women and in men. For example, when women read, there is a much more balanced amount of brain activity on both sides of the brain than there is in men. In men, it's very lateralized. That's measured by blood flow and tracing ions. And that being the case, there's something different about women's and men's brain organization. And I suppose organization of the brain has something to do with the makeup of the person, the way the person thinks, the way the person perceives, the way the person reacts. I'm going to have to ask you to wait until I get finished, because otherwise I'll never finish. There was a spate of studies done in the Scientific American in the last decade, cataloging differences in women's and men's perceptual abilities and abilities of coordination. For example, when asked to memorize a path, men memorize it by the geometry of the path, and women memorize it by the landmarks. If you'll tell me that this is a matter of just cultural custom or socialization, it turns out that the same thing is true for female and male rats, which probably aren't affected by the male chauvinist society that we live in. So it does seem that there are some basic differences in the way men and women think and perceive and organize. Finally, the closest thing to a controlled experiment in this issue was performed in this country, in Israel, from 1920 until the 1970s on the kibbutzim. So the left-wing kibbutzim were organized without any sexual bias. In fact, in many of them, there was no family structure. The boys and girls grew up in children's houses, slept in the same rooms, used the same showers. They developed a literature of women driving tractors and lifting bales of hay, and men caring for the children and working in the kitchen. And being a kibbutz, they had a fairly insulated society. And what they discovered was this. In the first two generations, there was a roughly equal distribution of labor. In the third generation, into the fourth generation, the distribution of labor polarized to be as polarized or more so than in the surrounding outside community. So a sociologist in the 70s did some interviews to try to figure out what happened. And the answer he got from the women he interviewed was this. The reason women's role is despised in the general culture is because it's not respected. Women's work is not respected. But on a kibbutz, everyone's work is respected. Everyone's contribution is honored. Whether you're the kibbutz economist or the kibbutz bus driver, you're honored for whatever you do. If that's so, said this woman, why shouldn't I do what I like? You men, it seems, when you go out into the fields and you lift heavy bales of hay and you come home soaked in sweat with aching muscles, that does something for you. Somehow you feel you've accomplished something. Well, frankly, for me as a woman, it doesn't do anything at all. I'd much rather be dealing with children. So if I'm going to be honored for what I do, why shouldn't I do what I like? Which indicates that even in a society whose values and whose educational system preaches equality of roles and equality of work, when left to their own natural desires, people are going to split on traditional lines. Now, I would say this evidence is not conclusive. It's not conclusive. It's too big an issue and too small an amount of evidence. But it is certainly suggestive. And it does mean anyone who still thinks that there are no essential differences between women and men owes us better evidence. He can't just take that position because it's obvious. It isn't obvious anymore. He would owe us better, more substantial, deeper, better understood, appreciated evidence than the evidence that we have. So, a society, a philosophy, a value structure, a belief system that distinguishes roles of women and men cannot be condemned as flying in the face of obvious facts that women and men are not significantly different. Because it isn't obvious that they're not significantly different at all. It may in fact not be true that they're not significantly different. They may very well be different. If one wants to argue, one would have to argue on the basis of the particulars. Women and men are equal in these ways, unequal in those ways, and your roles don't fit the actual equalities and inequalities. But since we know so little about the real equalities and inequalities, it's going to be hard to make that argument. At any rate, this is just some general background meant to inform your natural prejudice in favor of equality and identity, and perhaps open up your mind to another alternative. Now, in Meisman's book, almost everything I'm telling you is coming from Meisman. Maybe I'm adding 10%. Meisman points out that if you look into the Torah, the five books of Moses, and look at incidents in which women and men disagree as to what needs to be done, and it is a crisis, the women are always right. Here's the rule. When it's a crisis and women and men disagree as to what has to be done, the women are always right. So, Sarah and Abraham disagree bitterly over what to do with Yishmael. God tells Abraham, Sarah is right, you're wrong. Obey what she tells you. And he has to expel his son, which the Torah says is very evil in his eyes. And he has to do it anyway. Rebekah and Isaac, next generation, fight over what to do with Esau. Rebekah has given prophecy and thereby engineers what she knows has to be done against Isaac's will. And again, she's right and he's wrong. In Egypt, when the oppression got very bitter, Amram, Moses' father-to-be, divorced his wife. Amram's daughter, Miriam, argued with her father. The Gemara in Sota preserves four arguments that she made against him. And he admitted to her that he was wrong and remarried his wife. And by the way, being the leader of the generation, when Amram divorced his wife, so did everybody else. And when he took her back, so did everybody else. At another point in the oppression, when it got so bitter, when they were drowning the male babies in the river, the men simply refused to live with their wives. They said, well, what's the point of having children? To bring them into a world like this. So the Gemara tells us that the women, at the end of a day's labor, and the women were enslaved also, used to go to the fields where their men were lying, and they used to take with them two copper pots, one with some fish and one with some water. With the water they would wash their husbands, and they would cook the fish, and they would eat something. And then the wife would hold up a copper mirror. Remember, they came down as nobility. They were only enslaved labor, enslaved later. She would hold up a copper mirror in which they could both see their reflections, and she would say to her husband, am I not more beautiful than you are? And with those words, she would encourage her husband to father a child. In other words, you've given up, the wife says to the husband, but I have not, and you cannot deny me this. I take responsibility. And the Gemara concludes, it's on the basis of the righteousness of our mothers in Egypt that we were saved from Egypt. You know the story of the golden calf? That is, you've heard it. We'll talk about it in Yetzir Hashem, what it was, whether it was idol worship, wasn't idol worship. But one thing is, you need to know, the women did not participate. It was solely a male initiative, a male project, and only the men were guilty. The spies, of whom we read a few weeks ago, only the men rebelled. The women were prepared to go into the land of Israel. And therefore, nobody knows this, even though it's a Rashi and Chumash, and therefore the women did not die. In those 40 years in the wilderness, only the men died. The women did not die, and they went and inherited the land. Because they were prepared to do so. In each of these cases, you have a crisis situation, because each case, the decision was very important. There was no clear precedent. It required sensitivity, judgment, orientation. And in every case, the women were right and the men were wrong. That's a fact. What do we learn from this fact? Number one, women exercised independent judgment. The women did not say, "Oh, my lord, master, my husband, whatever you say, I'm a blind servant, you know, I glory in the privilege to wash your shoes, you know, and whatever you say, you know, becomes my mind, I have no mind of my own." On the contrary, they made up their minds on their own, made their own judgments, and when they were able to, they acted independently. Rebecca engineered a deception of Isaac. The women did not give their jewelry to the golden calf. The women who encouraged their husbands in Egypt to father a new generation. So they are capable of and exercise independent judgment and independent action to the extent that the circumstances permit. Those are two inferences directly from the facts. What is the basis of it? The basis goes back to the Torah's description of creation. Adam is created. The Torah records God's words. God says, "Lo tov heyos ha'odom levado." The correct translation is, "It is not good that man be alone." That's the correct translation. It is not good that man be alone. The translation is not, "It is not good for man to be alone." What's the difference? What's the difference between the correct translation, "It is not good that man be alone," versus the mistaken translation, "It is not good for man to be alone"? What difference does it make whether you have a "that" or a "for"?
It's saying that it's okay for man to be alone, that he can be alone. Whereas the other way, it's saying that he can't be alone.
"It is not good that man be alone," says.
"It is not good that man be alone," so that he should have a mate.
What's the difference between "it's not good that man should be alone" versus "it's not good for man to be alone"? You're not hearing it. Yeah.
God's saying is that it's not for man's sake that he's created. It's not good.
The wrong translation says it's not good for man to be alone. The solution will be something for man, something he needs, something that will do for him what he needs. That's the wrong translation. "It's not good that man be alone" says the circumstance, the situation of a soul man is not a good circumstance. What's not good about it? Doesn't give you a clue. A world with one man, a one-man situation, is not a good situation. What's not good about it? Who's it not good for? The Torah doesn't give you a clue. Now, the rabbinic tradition says that man is so uniquely superior to everything else in the creation that it can look like he is a kind of demigod over the creation. Because he's so uniquely superior, why woman had to be created. Listen once more. The problem is he's so uniquely superior that he will look like a kind of demigod over this creation. Therefore, woman is created. Query, can woman be created inferior to man? No. Why not? She won't solve the problem. Right? Because if she's inferior, he's still uniquely superior. And that's the problem we started with. No, she's got to be equal. She can't be superior either. Why not? It should be the problem. Right, quite right. No, they have to be equal. Good. That's logic 101. Now, the words with which God expresses his resolve to create woman are these. Esh Elohe Zekenegdo. I will make for him a helper against him. Right. A helper against him. I wonder what that means. Those of us who are married may know what it means. Now, the rabbinic explanation is this. If he deserves it, Zocha, the merited, she'll help him. If he doesn't deserve it, she'll be against him. Now let's think. Back to logic 101. Here's the man. If he deserves it, it means he makes good decisions, has good values, good priorities, then she helps him. And then she's also doing good. If he doesn't deserve it, he has bad values, bad priorities, makes bad decisions, then she's against him, which means she's doing good. Comes out, she's doing good either way. He could be right or wrong, but she's going to be right. That seems to be what the Talmud is saying. Okay, it mustn't be taken absolutely. Of course she has free will, of course she can make mistakes, but you don't get a picture here of any inferiority. Furthermore, if she's created to be an equal, then you understand the basis for the behavior we saw in the cases of crisis situations. Of course, she'll be able to make her own judgments and, if necessary, act independently. Now, our friendly critics will say, everything you've told us is balderdash. Everything you've told us is clearly refutable. Because, doesn't it say, right there in the book of Genesis, after they eat from the tree, God says to the woman, and you shall serve your husband. He shall rule you. Your husband shall rule you. I thought you shall. Who you shall rule? Says, he shall rule you. So there it is, black and white. The Torah is saying husband rules wife. At the risk of shock, this is not correct. This is not correct. Though it's a quote from Genesis, the person quoting it doesn't understand what it means. This is all in Meiselman's book. Because this quote, when God says to the woman, your husband will rule over you, this is a curse. This is a curse. And we have to ask, what is a curse? When the Torah expresses a curse, what does it mean? What kind of pronouncement is a curse? What kind of proposition is it? Here are two possibilities. We'll get to a third in a moment. Here are two possibilities. Either the curse is some kind of mitzvah, something you ought to do, you have responsibility to do, and suffer the consequences. One possibility. Or maybe a curse is an inescapable reality. I'm going to organize the world in such a way that you can't escape this terrible situation. Both of those are wrong. Both of those are surely incorrect. And here's the proof. In the very same verse, God says to the woman, you will give birth in pain. You'll give birth in pain. Now, is there any mitzvah that a woman should feel pain in childbirth? No, siri. A woman who wants to take anesthesia in childbirth, there's absolutely nothing barring her doing so. The frumest of the frum. That's the ultra, ultra, ultra orthodox. We'll take anesthesia without any hesitation, except for health problems, which are worthy of attention. But from the point of view of religious restrictions, there's no restriction whatsoever on taking anesthesia. So the idea that the curse is a mitzvah is certainly wrong. What about it being an inescapable reality? We just answered that, right? There is anesthesia, so it's not inescapable. It is eminently escapable. So that's a wrong shot. I'll give you another proof. What does it say to Adam? You're going to be a poor, unsuccessful farmer. Now, I know of quite a few from people who don't fit that description at all. Some diamond merchants living in Flatbush in their $2 million houses. You know, they're not getting thorns and thistles even in the backyard, let alone that being the whole subtotal of their lives. And no one ever tells them that you're living a religiously substandard existence, because Genesis says you have to be a poor farmer. So it is simply not true that these curses are either mitzvos or inescapable realities. So what are they? What is a curse? A curse, yeah? But my point is this: I have to know what the curse means before I examine questions like that. Does the curse mean that it's good, right, appropriate, important for these things to come true? Certainly not, because I gave you two examples in the context of the curses where we have no restrictions whatsoever that they should come true. So that's not what the curse is. Number two, is it an inescapable reality? No, because both of those realities have been escaped. So that's not what the curse means. So before you go analyzing whether or not the laws are gerrymandered one way or another, ask yourself what the text means. What are we dealing with here? The person's using the text to prove Judaism puts the woman under the man. So I say the context in which those words appear is the context of a curse. Let's ask, what is the meaning of a biblical curse? It isn't a mitzvah, and it isn't an inescapable reality. So what is it? And the answer is this. A curse in the Torah is something which can happen. There are natural forces which can lead to make it happen. If it happens, it's terrible, and you should do everything you can to avoid it. It's something that can happen. There are natural forces which make a tendency for it to happen normally, and you should do everything you can to avoid it. Like the Path of the Just by Luzzatto says, a man will tell you, I only have 2 or 3 hours a day to study Torah because I'm working, earning a living. Doesn't the Torah say in Genesis that I have to work to earn a living? Says the answer, says Luzzatto, is working to earn a living is a tax. It's a tax because of a sin. Because of that sin, you're not given a free living like we were in the Garden of Eden. No, you have to work to get it. Show me someone who volunteers to pay extra taxes. Not going to find it, right? So what are you doing? If you can make your living in 6 hours and you spend 8 hours working, you're paying 2 hours extra taxes. You wouldn't do that to the government. Sure, it's a tax. And indeed, force of necessity may require you to participate in the tax, but you minimize it as much as possible. That's true for all of them. And as we will see in the next session when I talk about Jewish law is structured in such a way as to prevent the husband from ruling over the wife. But I told you, we're not doing law today. We're doing general philosophical orientation. Okay. I have 2 major points and a comment, and I hope we'll have some time for questions. There is a general Jewish value of tzniyus. Tzniyus means privacy. Tzniyus means privacy. It means not attracting attention. It involves, but is not limited to, covering certain parts of the body. Tzniyus is a value for both men and women. The verse in Hosea says, "Hatznei alechasim alokecha." Walk with tzniyus with your God. It has nothing to do with women particularly. It has to do with every Jew. Indeed, it would be a good recommendation for every human being. Tzniyus means being essentially unknown, not attracting attention. Not being an item of social focus. Now, every Jew has a challenge to achieve that value. Maybe if you could turn on that air conditioner in the back so things get warm. Every Jew has a responsibility to work on tzniyus. But not everybody has an equal responsibility. Not everyone has an equal responsibility. In other words, now I'm choosing these numbers arbitrarily. They have no meaning, just for illustration. They're just for illustration. Let's say you have 10 central values you have to work to achieve. On the list of 10, on the men's list, sneeze will be number 7. On the women's list, it'll be number 3. I don't really mean 7 and 3. I mean, just, that's the illustration. It's higher up on, it's on both lists, but it's higher up on their list than it is on our list. That means that if there is an activity which must be public, for a woman to engage in that activity is a bigger compromise, a bigger threat, a bigger injury to her spirituality than it would be for a man. It's an injury for a man also, but it's not as big an injury. The illustration of this is a really shocking midrash, which Meiselman cites. The verse in Proverbs said, Ecclesiastes, all the glory of the woman is inwardness. Ask the Midrash. All the glory of the daughter of the king. The glory of the daughter of the king is inward. Ask the Midrash. Who's the daughter of the king? Who's this woman who's being described as the daughter of the king? You ask me, I think of Sarah or Esther or Rachel, or who knows? Well, the Midrash says the daughter of the king is Moses. It's a bit surprising. And the Midrash explains that when Moses communed with God in the tent of meeting, he went in alone, closed the flap, and had no observers and no partners. He was totally alone. And that thereby he acquired the title daughter of the king. Now, how are we supposed to understand this? Is this perhaps maybe a put down of Moses? You know, kind of slap in the face? You're only functioning like a woman? Not likely in a male chauvinist tradition, right? Probably not putting Moses down. So what does it mean to give Moses a feminine title? The answer is that since we are now describing his news, his privacy, and since privacy is more so a feminine virtue than a male virtue, then when a man achieves it, he gets a feminine title. Bas Melech, the daughter of the king. And Meiselman points out that the great heroic events in Jewish history tend to be events that take place in private, as against the Greek tradition. Abraham is told to sacrifice his son Isaac. Where does this happen? At the top of the mountain. Totally in isolation. There's no one there. Not even the two servants that are left at the bottom of the mountain. Jacob wrestles with an angel and learns that his name is going to be changed by Yivasa Yaakov Levado. He's left alone. No one is together with him. Moses goes to get the tablets and the Torah of Mount Sinai alone. No one accompanies him. Moses in the tent of meeting, as we saw. The high priest on Yom Kippur, the high point of the service, is presenting the incense in front of the ark in the Holy of Holies, behind the parochas, in complete isolation, with no observance. So, great moments in Jewish spirituality are moments that take place in private, and privacy is more a feminine virtue than a male virtue, though men and women are equal, are both, not equally, but both required to develop it. Now, says Meiselman, this helps explain a large asymmetry in women's and men's roles, that positions of authority tend to be, are mostly occupied by men. So, for example, before there was a king, we had almost 400 years without a permanent chief executive. When we needed one, especially when there were wars to be fought, one was appointed. He was called the Shofet. Now I know you learned in dictionary, Shofet means judge. But in the period of the Shofet fought war, negotiated peace, raised taxes, he functions like a chief executive in addition to playing a judicial role as well. All of the shoftim were men, except one. Devorah was the shoftim for 40 years, more than 10% of the whole period. So, a woman did occupy the role, but it was atypical. It's the sort of thing which was very rare. One explanation is the fact that roles of authority are necessarily public. If your word is law, then people have got to know what you said. Otherwise, you can't be law for the society. So roles of authority are necessarily public, and because they're public, they are a bigger compromise for women than they are for men, and that is part of the explanation. I don't say it's the whole explanation, but it's part of the explanation why typically women do not occupy positions of authority. Now, Meisman at this point makes an extremely important remark. In political philosophy, there is a central distinction between authority and power. Authority is a legal concept. It means that according to the structure of society, when one person says something, it creates a norm that is binding on everybody. Power is a physical concept. Power is the ability to get done what you want done. These two are completely independent of one another. A person can have power without authority and authority without power. You've heard the phrase, the power behind the throne? That means that the king is there and he signs the documents, but somebody behind is telling him what to sign. We have that diffused. How many senators and how many representatives are in the pockets of some lobby? And when a vote comes up, the lobby calls and says, vote this way, or next time you're not going to win because you won't have any money. So the senator's hand goes up and he's counted, but somebody else is pulling his hand up with a piece of string from behind, and the hand goes up and down when the guy behind is pulling. One guy has the authority, the other guy has the power. Power can be private. Power doesn't have to be visible. Authority necessarily is visible. Power doesn't have to be visible. Therefore, women can possess power. They typically don't possess authority, but they can possess power. So says Meiselman, if you are hypnotized by publicity, then for you, authority is very important. You want your name in the papers. If what's important to you, on the contrary, is privacy, you want to avoid getting your name in the papers, then you are very wary of authority. But you would like to know that you have your say in making things happen. So the question from our point of view is, do women have power? Do women have power? Now, the difficulty here is that it's hard to measure power. Authority can be measured by the laws. There are particular positions that are open that have authority, and who can fill them? Power is more a matter of your influence or your ability to get done what you need to be done, what you need to have done. And there, it's much more difficult to measure. But we can give a rough estimate. Let's take a look at the examples that we gave. Sarah and Abraham disagree about what has to happen to Ishmael. Whose will gets done? Sarah's will gets done. Who signs the expulsion order? Abraham. He has the authority. Only he can say go. And he says it. He says it because she wanted it. So here, he is the throne, and she's the power behind the throne. If anything, he becomes her tool to get done what she wants done. Now, this exercise of power runs throughout Jewish history. After all real power is the power of persuasion. Listen carefully. All real power is the power of persuasion. No person can dominate a country unless he has thousands and thousands of people who are willing to shoot the bullets for him. And he's got to convince them to shoot those bullets. Saddam Hussein was running the country only because he had a couple of million people who were willing to kill everybody else. Without those couple of million, there's nothing. All power is really the power of persuasion. To get people to do what you want them to do by convincing or using pressure to mold their minds. Jewish women had exercised this kind of power from the beginning to the end. Jewish society is structured in such a way as to orient men to be responsive to women's exercise of this kind of power. From the stories that we talked about in the Torah, through the Talmudic period to the present, when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was voted to be the head of Sanhedrin, head of Sanhedrin, that is the most honored, most authoritative position in the whole of the Jewish people at that time. There was no king at that time. What did he say when he won the election? He said, gentlemen, I'm very happy for your vote of confidence in me. I'm going home to ask my wife. Just imagine this in the feminist stereotype of the Jewish woman. Who's he going home to ask? The bottle washer, the diaper changer, the floor sweeper. He's going to ask her whether he should become the head of Sanhedrin. Who is she? What does she know? How is she able to answer? It's all right. He's not taking it unless she agrees. There's a yeshiva in Baltimore called Ney Yisrael. It was founded, I guess, about 80 years ago. Shortly after the founder set it up in a private home with a few students, he was offered a job in New York to become part of the staff of one of the big yeshivas in New York. He was ready to go. His wife said, you can't leave Baltimore without a yeshiva. So he stayed. That's why Baltimore has a yeshiva. About 14 years ago, I witnessed a conversation in my building in Harnoff. I was sitting on my porch, and there was another couple, two floors above, on their porch, and the wife made a statement, quite loudly. She said to her husband, I forbid you to call your mother until we pay back the money. This is a woman forbidding her husband to call his own mother. This is a Haredi couple. So, the stereotypes that women exercise no power are simply false. Now, I don't blame you for the stereotypes. When I was in your position, I had the same stereotypes, because I read the New York Times, and it's full of lies. Not only because of this guy they fired, not only because of him, but the Jewish reporters lie also. It's full of lies. But you have to know and make an investigation and see how families actually function and see how decisions are made, and you'll understand that women exercise very considerable power. Is it equal? I don't know how to measure it, frankly. I don't know how to put a number on it. But it is very considerable power. And that being the case, the power is really shared, even though there is an imbalance in the positions of authority. Now, oh boy. One more remark I want to make. There is a blessing that we say in the Siddur in the morning. Men say the blessing, blessed are you, Hashem, God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman. Oh my. There it is, black on white. Forget everything else he said. It says right there. He's thanking God for not having made him a woman. So clearly men have to be superior to women. Here's a rule. If you walk out of Rosh Hashanah with this rule in your pocket and nothing else, you have done a good job. Sociology, anthropology, psychology, history, economics, philosophy, all comes second. First comes text. First understand what it says. Then get your ologists in to analyze what it means. If you don't know what it says, then you're analyzing the moon. You're not analyzing anything real. Now, this blessing is not made me a woman. It's one of a trio. The trio reads, you have not made me a non-Jew, you have not made me a slave, you have not made me a woman. He has not. Women make the first two. Men make all three. First question, how are these categories chosen? Jew versus non-Jew, free versus slave, man versus woman. How are the categories chosen? Number two, why are they made negative? All three could have been made positive. You made me a Jew, you made me free, you made me a man. If you don't know the answers to those questions, you don't know what the text says. If you don't know what it says, then all the ologies are incompetent. Now here's the understanding of what it means. The categories are categories of mitzvot. These blessings are expressions of our responsibilities. What am I in the world to do? Non-Jews have about 65 commandments from God that they have to keep. Where am I? Which commandments apply to me? So I say, I'm not in that category. Not in the 65 category. There's a certain type of slave who has a much larger selection of commandments applied to him. I'm not in that category either. So now, I'm not a non-Jew, I'm not a slave. There's one ambiguity left. Of the 613 commandments, about 15 are addressed preferentially to men. It didn't say exclusively, it said preferentially. They're addressed preferentially to men. Are those addressed to me or not? I haven't answered that question yet. So a man has to go on and say, yes, also those 15 apply to me as well. That's why a man has to go to the third stage. A woman, when she says that she's not a non-Jew, and she's free, and she's not a slave, has already put herself into the class of all those who are addressed by all the mitzvahs except for those 15. And that's true for her. So she's correctly identified her category. That's why the categories are set up the way they are. Let me just finish that. I'll try. Now, why negative? Why not positive? The answer is this. We regard ourselves typically as not complete successes in living up to our responsibilities. So, if I proclaim, blessed are you, Hashem, God, King of the universe, who has made me Jewish, the immediate question will be, you are so positive about your Jewish identity. Are you living up to your Jewish responsibilities? You aren't? Then how do you trumpet with such confidence the fact that you're a Jew? And we take that question very seriously. And therefore we don't do it. What we say is, you didn't make me a non-Jew. Everybody knows the law of double negation. If you didn't make me a non-Jew, I have to be Jewish. But I didn't say it. I only implied it. It's a measure of sensitivity to the fact that we are not succeeding in what we are supposed to do. Same thing with free and slave. If I say you made me free, the question will be, what are you doing with your freedom? Are you really succeeding in using your freedom the appropriate way? The answer is no. If so, then I can't trumpet the fact that I'm free. So I say, I'm not a slave. And everybody knows the slave and free are the only two categories. But I only implied it. And the same thing's true with man and woman. If I say that I'm a man, the question will be, how are you fulfilling the responsibilities of being a man? Then I'll have to say, not so well. So I don't say that I'm a man. I say that I'm not a woman. That's the reason for the categories and for the negative statement. If you can make allergies out of that, it'll be nice to hear. But it has to be based on that understanding of what they mean. Now, women say, it made me according to his will. All right. Trick question. How do they get away saying it net positive? Didn't I just explain why they're all made negative? The answer is, he has made me according to his will is not an expression of responsibility. It's an expression of essence. If you're talking about what God made you, you can make it in the positive. If you're talking about your responsibilities, then you have to make it in the negative. Made me according to his will is an expression of essence. It's not an expression of responsibilities. Well, what does it mean? It's a very funny phraseology, isn't it? He made me according to his will. Was there another alternative? Make me according to somebody else's will? So, the plain meaning of the words is this. He made me in such a way that I naturally fulfill his will. He put in me some principle whereby I'm naturally disposed to fulfill his will. That's on the basis of such a phrase you find in a dozen other places. Which may be another reason why women can be counted on in crisis situations. Privacy being one, and this being another. Now, so, in the end, the blessing does not indicate inferior status or the fact that a man is overjoyed by the fact that he's not made a woman. It means that he has to acknowledge the responsibilities that he has. Now, usually at 4:30 I do text upstairs, but because this is a very central subject, and because I didn't have a chance to let you ask, those who want to continue this discussion at 4:30 in the library. I'm happy to do that instead of text. This will be an exception to my general rule, so that if you have questions that you want to ask, I'll be glad to do them then.
So,
This says a Chavruta review of Gemara.
Yeah, we should stay here.